It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, holiday baking season is here, but with smaller family gatherings this year, it's a great time to try something new. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll talk to the Wisconsin baker about how to get creative with some classic recipes. Now, have you ever wanted to feel happier, less lonely, more connected to the place you live? Our next guest says the answer may be talking to strangers. He says that in a world of polarization and rising rates of loneliness, connections with strangers could be the missing piece. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you start up conversations with strangers? If so, in what settings? What do you talk about? If not, has a stranger talked to you? How do you feel when that happens? Do you have questions about how to break the ice with somebody you don't know anything about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joe Cohen is a writer and editor working with publications including Medium, Esquire, and Wired. His new book is called The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thanks so much for having me on.
Were you a natural talker to strangers before you set out on what led to this book, or were you more like me and a little more shy about it?
I was definitely raised by people who talk to strangers all the time. I grew up in Boston, so I got to see my parents kind of chatting up everyone everywhere they went. And even more important, I saw them make friends like throughout their entire lives. So I was definitely raised in the sort of environment where that was normal. And Boston tends to be like a pretty garrulous place. But for me, I kind of fell in the middle. I've been working as a journalist for 20 years, which means I talk to strangers all the time. But I found at a certain point a few years ago that I had kind of stopped doing it out in the wild in coffee shops and bars, things like that. And I kind of wondered why that had happened. And that was the beginning of the book.
We are often suspicious of strangers. You even referenced that, the subtitle to your book. We've had stranger danger and worries about, you know, what does that person want? Are they going to try to sell me something? Whatever. Why are we so reluctant to talk to people?
Yeah, it's a complicated answer. I mean, certainly, first of all, for people of my generation, you were raised with the stranger danger propaganda, which literally meant police officers like coming into your school and telling you that everyone you don't know in the world poses a mortal threat to you, which, as it turns out, is not the healthiest thing to tell a child. But there are other things, too. You know, I think humans are naturally wary of strangers. That's always been the case. That's unavoidable. But then there are all sorts of impediments that keep people from having these interactions. And those can be varied. They can range from fear of rejection to concerns that they won't have anything to talk about to concerns that this just simply isn't a thing that's done.
You reference, there's a long history and prehistory of a value of talking to strangers. You look at ancient Greece and the values found in the Odyssey, where if you're mean to strangers, you'll end up dying. Christianity, Islam, the list goes on and on. There's so many injunctions in the world saying, you got to take care of strangers. Why has that been such a fundamental part of humanity?
It's just, you know, we kind of have a dial. Some philosophers have argued that we have a moral dial. And under certain circumstances, we can be really xenophobic and really dehumanizing and really violent. And in other circumstances, we can be extraordinarily cooperative and communicative and open to interacting with people we don't know. So under the right circumstances, we're amazingly good at living with strangers and talking to strangers and cooperating with strangers, especially in the context of the natural world. You know, I'm a journalist, so I tend to be skeptical, kind of verging on cynical, obviously. But I came away from this project being much more optimistic because you realize, you know, the more pessimistic knock against humanity is that we are by nature xenophobic, right? That we are afraid of strangers, that we are hostile. But civilization doesn't happen if that's our default mode. You know, if that's our default, we're fighting in small bands forever, for a million years. Instead, because we have this capacity that you don't see in other primates, you don't see anywhere else, to live with strangers and work with strangers and cooperate with strangers, that allowed cities to happen, that allowed communities, bigger communities to happen, nations to happen, all these things. It's a phenomenally powerful phenomenally powerful gift that we have to do this, but we don't give ourselves enough credit for it.
In the book, you go from that big picture, broad stroke of human civilization and evolution to individuals in 2021. What do I get out of talking to strangers in this day and age?
Yeah, it's a funny thing because it is like it's been universal. It's been a very common thing for tens of thousands of years for humans to live among strangers. And yet it's only recently that psychologists started studying what happens. And that's twofold. You know, what keeps us from having these interactions, but what happens when we do have them? And on the latter point, what's been really interesting, and this has been a pretty universal finding across different cultures, different countries, you know, men, women, different people of different ages, is that when people have interactions with strangers, when they talk to strangers, and it can be fleeting, it can be more meaningful, longer, whatever the interaction, they report coming back feeling happier, feeling more connected to their communities, feeling an enhanced sense of belonging, which is really important at a time like ours, where people feel sort of estranged from the culture, from the people around them. They feel less lonely, which is really important. They feel more optimistic about humanity because, you know, there's a kind of quirk of human wiring that when we have one positive interaction, we tend to generalize that. So, you know, when you come out of a childhood like mine, where you're just like conditioned to fear strangers, and you have a positive interaction with one, you're like, okay, well, that's reassuring. Like, I don't have to worry about that person like throwing me in a van and taking me away. You know what I mean? And so the more you do it, the more that generalizes, and the more positive you start to feel about the people around you. And from, you know, I've always been kind of skeptical. I'm not the type of person who would naturally conclude this, but I came away from this project feeling way better about people, even in a fairly, you know, tumultuous time.
We're talking to Joe Cohen about his new book, The Power of Strangers: The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. You could join in if you like to talk to strangers or don't like it. Let us know. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Joe, before we get to our callers, you spend a lot of your time researching this book, going to people who have taught people how to talk to strangers, who have really embraced the idea of bridging this gap. You went to London, of all places, where stereotypically people don't talk to strangers, where there were classes. What did you learn about how to take that first step and talk to that stranger?
Yeah, if you felt like me, which was, I felt like I was out of shape, you know, the reasons why I had stopped talking to strangers for the most part had to do with just reliance on my phone, which I think is pretty universal at this point. And also that I was tired. I had a demanding job and I had a young kid and I was exhausted. So I wasn't hanging around. I didn't have the bandwidth. The really reassuring thing to me is that you can pretty easily build yourself back up socially. The project for me was I wanted to start from zero, almost like couch potato to marathoner, right? And I wanted to understand every step of the way as you go. So in the book, I lay out, like, you know, it's like a circuit training for becoming a social creature again after, like, you know, years in the hole of technology and COVID after that. And it starts very simple. It starts with, you know, resolving to make eye contact and say good morning to people. It has to do with when you ask someone how they are, actually mean it, actually be inquisitive about them, about their answer. And when they ask you how you are, you know, you can give them a real answer. You don't want to complain for a half an hour, but like you can be honest and they'll respond to that. And, you know, I found it came naturally. Eventually, it was much easier than I thought. And the research backs this up, that while people are very pessimistic in some places, I think, you know, it depends on the culture and the region. People are very pessimistic about this. But when they actually do go out to seek out these interactions, they find it goes much better than they had anticipated. And for some people, it becomes a habit.
Well, we've got a lot of people who want to talk to us about talking to strangers. Let's hear from them. And let's start with Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Well, good afternoon. During the summer months, I'm a vendor at Civil War. I was a vendor at Civil War, and I still am, so I'm a vendor at Civil War and special events. I run a shoeshine stand, and I never let the public go by me, pretty much. I engage them. I may just say hi. I wonder how the apple trees are getting along in the Antarctic this year. I get a smile out of them, and pretty soon you get a conversation going. But you don't let the public go by you. You engage them. And I see a few vendors that do that. They stand there and they don't engage the public. You just say a pleasant hi. Sometimes they'll just move on and that'll be it. And sometimes they won't. But you never know what you'll learn. Pretty much.
Eugene, thank you so much for sharing that. I'm lucky enough to have had the chance to chat with you in person a time or two over the years. Joe, Eugene says you never know what you're going to learn when you talk to a person. You share a lot of that in the book.
Yeah, that's the beautiful thing about it. You know, if you go into a conversation with an agenda and with like things that you want to talk about, you'll never get anything interesting or surprising. But if you go into a conversation being kind of open about the person and curious about the person, then in my experience, we talked to, you know, so many people for this book, they will unfailingly surprise you. You never know where it's going to go. And it becomes like, you know, for me, it became a form of travel. It was like an adventure.
Eugene, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Let's go now to Michael in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. Funny story. I actually called in for the previous guest and just hung around because I I had things to say about this one too. So I make a habit of talking to strangers, and much like the guest was saying about growing up watching his parents talk to strangers in Boston. You know, when I was a kid, we would go on trips during the summer, a lot of times to national parks. And a lot of national parks have programs where they will bring in student workers from countries all over the world. And so, and especially my dad would make a habit of talking to as many of these, you know, kids as he could. He always found it interesting. And now I'm, you know, in my early 30s, and I live in Appleton near downtown, and people will walk past my house all the time. And I'll talk to people from my porch, you know, just kind of talk to people if I run into them somewhere. And I always try to, you know, if someone seems interesting or they're wearing a shirt that I think is cool or just something, you know, I find something to sort of break that ice and get into a conversation. And you know, you can learn some really interesting things about people, like
awesome.
The guest was saying.
Michael, thanks a lot for telling us your story. And Joe, Michael brings up an interesting point, that opening statement, an opening thing to bring up to talk to someone who you don't know much about except for what you see.
Yeah, he raises a great point. You know, paradoxically, the key to talking to strangers, I found, has nothing to do with talking. It has everything to do with noticing and then listening. Noticing maybe something that the other person is doing, or noticing something that you're both experiencing at the same time, remarking on it, and then just hanging back and letting them talk. And, you know, to my previous point, just letting them surprise you with their story.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Joe Cohane about his new book. It's called The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we'd be better off if we all talk to each other a little more? Do you talk to strangers, whether it's your postal delivery person or someone in the checkout line? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Running a business requires smart decisions every day. Make a good decision for your company today and reach other businesses through Wisconsin Public Radio sponsorship. For more information, call Jay Johnston at 414-202-1961.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our talk with Joe Cohane. His new book is called The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. Back to your calls now. Steve joins us in Winona. Steve, hi.
Hey, I'm across the river from you, but I can pick you up loud and clear.
Excellent.
I wanted to say that about 30 years ago, a little over 30 years ago, my life changed. And prior to that, I was the guy, don't stay away from me, don't talk to me, just leave me alone. Whether it was depression or whatever, it doesn't make a difference. That's no way to go through life. And I got connected with this group of people that helped me get rid of a vice. And they talked a lot, and they talked to everybody. And I learned it's okay to talk to people. And it's interesting because today, I mean, I value my quiet times, and I like walking around a crowd of people and not talking to people too. But for the most part, when I came into Minnesota a couple of weeks ago, I stopped at a rest area, and here was a group of it was just a big family, huge family, and they were trying to take pictures of themselves against the Mississippi River. And naturally, one person's taking pictures. Now they switch, and then the next person takes pictures of everybody, and then they switch. And I came over and I said, hey, would you like me to take a picture of all of you? And they were so excited. I took a couple pictures with their phone, and then they went back to talking. And then I looked up, and there was an eagle flying. And I said, look up, there's a bald eagle above us. And they were like, oh, they were just so amazed to see that.
Excellent.
But you know what, if you don't, and it really wasn't much conversation, but it helped them to have a better day. And I'll tell you what, somebody told me a long time ago, they said, when you shine the spotlight on somebody else, you can't help but splash some of that back on yourself.
Steve, yeah. I love it. Thanks so much for sharing your conversion experience there to talking to strangers. And yeah, it doesn't have to necessarily, Joe, be a huge, long-running interaction. Like, even the little things like that can be a big deal, right?
Yeah, you definitely get a little buzz out of it. It's funny. My wife is like the queen of taking pictures of people for them. And that definitely influenced me. And then I ended up, you know, to Steve's point, what he did was he helped them, but he also represented his state, his area for these people who are visiting. And they're going to come away and they're going to say, those people are great because of Steve, because of one guy, because we generalize our experiences in a lot of ways. And over the process of doing this book, I started doing a lot more of that, like being more deliberately helpful to tourists, being more deliberately helpful to people. And I did like the fact that I knew that they were going to come away from this feeling better about the city where I live. I live in New York. They would go home and they would say, people are so nice there. You know, it would be because like I took their picture. It doesn't take that much to make somebody's day better.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Steve, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Joe Cohen about his new book, The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. Let's go now to Rita calling from Franklin. Rita, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say my millennial offspring shake their heads and one of them turns away. But, hey, I've done it all my life. It has always benefited me. And maybe
the others. Rita, thanks for the call. So Rita talks to strangers. Her kids are embarrassed by it. Joe, I don't know. Do you have advice for parents on how to bring their kids on board with politely talking to strangers?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just have to keep doing it and show them that it works, you know. But she raised an interesting point, which is there is a generational divide. For my parents' generation, it was much more normal to do this. And for younger people, specifically like 18 to 22, like much younger, they're so accustomed to doing all their communication on phones, on digital platforms, that their social skills have sort of eroded. So they might be embarrassed about their parent, but they also greet the prospect of just like chatting someone up, just interacting with someone in public with a sort of horror because they don't feel they know how to do it. So a really good lesson to impart to younger people is it's much easier than you think. You know, this is like an intrinsic capacity that we have. You just have to sharpen it a little bit. You have to work those muscles a little bit. And when you do it a few times, you know, most people will find that it's a pretty positive experience.
Thanks for the call, Rita. We'll go to Dave now in Appleton. Dave, hi.
Hi. Thank you. I love the title of your book. I engage people in conversations and I take pictures of strangers with my phone. I will talk to them a little bit, and then I'll say, you know what I do just for fun is I take pictures of strangers. Would you allow me to take your picture?
Okay.
90% of the time, they'll say yes.
Awesome. And does that help strike up conversations, those people who are willing to have their picture taken?
Oh, it sure does, because it's often not the lead-in, but it's a culmination after a conversation. Can I also take your picture?
Interesting.
And then I'll have some things. I'll ask some things like, what's your source of joy? And that leads into some interesting discussions as well.
Interesting, Dave. Thanks a lot. I'm glad, Joe, that he asked for permission to take pictures. I don't know that that would be a good icebreaker otherwise.
Yeah, there's an interesting point to be made here, too, which is, you know, because we tend to be wary of strangers, you do need to connect first, right? You have to kind of make people a little more comfortable, make them, you know, to kind of alleviate any suspicion they might have about what your intentions are. And so really just talking to them and coming across as like a good person to talk to, that might make them more open to something like a photo. Whereas if I just walked up to someone and I was like, can I take your picture? They would think that I was nuts. Like I haven't primed it properly. I haven't forged the relationship that would allow them to feel comfortable with me taking their picture.
Thanks for the call, Dave. Time for one more caller. Sue in South Range is with us now. Sue, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I wanted to tell you about an experience I had on a little island hop from Hawaii to Maui. My husband and I were sitting there talking about the car we were going to rent when we got on Maui, and we were going to drive around the island. And the fellow next to me said, oh, he said, by the way, if you do that, be sure to go counterclockwise around the island. That way you'll always be on the mountainside. You won't be on the side of the road that has the cliffs. The whole trip was so much more comfortable just because we talked to strangers.
I'm sorry, it sounds a little like you're on a plane right now, but she talked to someone and got valuable advice for her travels on it, Joe. It could pay off pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, you don't know what you don't know. So talking to people can introduce you to things that you never even considered before.
Well, Joe, 1 minute or so left. Leave us with a pep talk, maybe a bit of advice to find an opportunity to have a quick conversation with a stranger.
Yeah. So the best technique that I found came from a woman named Georgie Nightingale, who taught the class you mentioned in London, which I took for 4 days. And it involves what she calls breaking the script. So, it's called a preframe. I get confused. It's called a preframe. So when you're in a situation where you want to talk to someone, but it might not be the norm to do it, it might not be a social norm, you need to reassure them that you're not a threat and you're not crazy and you're not dangerous and you're not a creep. And the way to do that is to acknowledge that you know you're breaking the norm. So instead of me leaning over to someone on the subway here in New York and just like starting to talk to them, which they're going to be kind of suspicious of, I lean over and say, look, I know we're not supposed to talk to people on the subway, but I really like your glasses. You know, I'm in the market for a pair of glasses myself. Would you mind telling me where you got them from? And that little technique, just acknowledging that you're doing something that's outside of the norm, is tremendously reassuring to people. And it's a really good way to start a conversation. And it's also sort of audacious and it's sort of charming and it's sort of funny. And I did it a lot and it worked phenomenally well. It's a really easy and effective way to do it.
Fantastic advice, Joe. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It was a real pleasure.
Joe Cohane is a writer and editor. His new book is called The Power of Strangers: The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. There's still time for you to share your story about talking to strangers. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if you like to do it, don't like to do it, if you have some advice on how to get the ball rolling. Again, that's the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're going to talk to a Wisconsin baker about how to put a new spin on our holiday baking this year. Maybe we're cooking for a small audience, baking for a smaller audience than usual, and it's a chance to try something new. We've got a couple recipes up already, actually, at WPR.org/Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around and get ready to call in with your holiday baking favorites. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's Food Friday. This week we're talking about holiday baking. It's the time of year when we might start whipping up big batches of cookies or other favorites for our family gatherings. But with a lot of those gatherings scaled down this year, it's a great time to try something new. And our next guest has ideas on putting a new spin on some of the classics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite things to bake during the holidays? Are there old family recipes you like to pull out? Are you thinking of trying something new this year? Have you been able to take a simple recipe and give it that little extra something? Or do you need some help? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sean Bolduc is owner of the Baked Lab in Madison, where he bakes custom cakes and teaches baking workshops. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, this time of year, Sean puts a lot of people in the baking mood. And I know you have to be in the baking mood all year long, but does this time of year give you a little bit of that extra inspiration?
Oh, man. I mean, there's no better time to bake than the holidays, right? It's like baking is all about sharing and giving. And what better way to show how much you love somebody than through some baked goods?
I understand when you're teaching classes, Sean, you like to inspire people to find things where they can kind of improvise and experiment with new things. And I got to say, when I cook, I'm all about doing that. I can start making a soup and not know what kind of soup it's going to be till halfway through. But mostly when I'm baking, it's like I'm back at high school chemistry class and I got to do things just the right way. How can I loosen up, man?
Oh, I know. I mean, baking is definitely a science. It's all about the chemistry. But what I like to teach in my workshops is that, you know, when you have a base recipe, like a pound cake or something like that, there's so many different ways that you can flavor it and make it different a million times over, right? So you take that base recipe and then one time you add some orange zest to it. And then the next time you add some cinnamon spice to it and you've got a completely different baked good this time, right?
Yeah, and that reminds me, one of the recipes you passed along to us, we're going to have that up at WPR.org/Food Friday, an orange and Aperol loaf. Interesting flavor. It's one thing that you can use that basic template and then jazz it up. So talk about this loaf itself. And first of all, did I say it right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I love some Aperol, right? A nice aperitivo to have before some dinner. But why not add it to your baked goods? I'm all about adding some booze to my baked goods. But this recipe is just a standard pound cake. And I spiced it up this year with a little bit of orange zest and then a nice little sweet drizzle on top of it that's got some orange and Aperol mixed into it. And I'd love to hear what other people are thinking that they can do with this pound cake as well.
Now, talk about the loaf itself. How does this come together? How easy is it for me to make?
Oh, man, this is like one of the most simple recipes, right? You throw a bunch of dry ingredients, your sugar, your flour, your baking powder, all into a bowl together. You add some room temperature butter to it, mix it up, and then you add your wet ingredients and you've got your loaf ready to go. It couldn't be any easier. It's a great beginner recipe, but then it's fun to kind of figure out what you can do from there and change up the flavors next time you make it.
Yeah. So you mentioned the orange zest and the little booze here as the topping we've got online. What other things might you do with that basic loaf to add a completely different twist to it?
Sure. So, you know, flavor profile wise, you could add any type of spice that you wanted to the loaf itself. So you can add cinnamon, you could add a special type of cinnamon. And then, you know, the glaze is just powdered sugar with some type of liquid in it. So you could basically take any type of liquid out of your refrigerator and add it to it, and it'll add its own little flavor profile. So you could do like orange and cranberry, or you could do a bourbon on top of it. Like literally the flavor profiles are endless.
And then you can make this look fancy with that drizzle and how you lay it on there. How do we get the consistency right? Not too thin, not too thick, so we can kind of be artistic with it on top of the loaf.
Totally. I think that making a glaze is like the easiest possible thing that you can do, right? So you've got powdered sugar. You know, I always start for something like this size, about a cup and a half of powdered sugar. And then I'll start with anywhere around like 2 tablespoons of a liquid with it, right? So all of a sudden you're mixing it up and you're like, oh man, this is really thin. So all you need to do to thicken it up a little bit and get it to a consistency that seems right for you is to add a little bit more powdered sugar. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, if for some reason you've got a glaze that ends up being a little too thick, you just add a little bit more liquid to it.
Talking to Sean Bolduc, baker based in Madison, owner of the Baked Lab. He's giving us some inspiration for trying some new baking projects over this holiday season. Hey, maybe you don't have the big family get together. You don't need 15 dozen sugar cookies to share out among everybody. You want to try something new? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let us know what you're baking. Maybe baking this weekend. Maybe you're in the kitchen right now. If you need some advice from Sean, he may be able to answer your baking questions and concerns. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, Sean, you let us know you're a big fan of baking for breakfast. I love baked goods for breakfast or any time, really. You shared with us a recipe for sticky buns, which is hard to go wrong with. Tell us about these guys.
Oh, totally. I know that everybody has been completely obsessed with making sourdough breads this during the quarantine. And most of us probably have a little bit of yeast left over in our refrigerators that we purchased earlier on. Why not make a brioche dough wrapped in cinnamon sugar, topped with like a caramel and pecans for breakfast on Christmas morning, right? So this is basically just a standard brioche dough, an enriched dough. It's got butter in it. It's got some eggs in it, all mixed up. You're going to go ahead and proof that, right? So we're going to let it rise for a couple of hours. And then we're going to turn it into some cinnamon buns and prep it and let it proof overnight in the refrigerator, ready to go on Christmas morning to pop in the oven and have for breakfast.
Okay, but once I know how to make that brioche dough, Sean, where can I take that if I want some variety in my life?
Oh, man. Brioche dough can be used in a million different ways. The first way that comes to mind is a standard just bread, right? So you could make that brioche dough, pop it in a loaf tin and let that rise. And then you've got a beautiful loaf of brioche dough. You can also use it for something called a babka. Have you heard of a babka before?
I have. I don't know that I could define it for you, though.
Right. So I actually work with another person here in town. We share a kitchen together, and she makes babka on the regular. That's her business. So babka is a brioche dough. It's similarly rolled out like you would a cinnamon bun. It's filled just like you would a cinnamon bun with a bunch of stuff. It's rolled up, but then the cool thing is that it's sliced down the center so you can see all of those beautiful layers of different fillings, and then it's braided and then baked as a loaf. So it's more of a sweet loaf that's got something in it like, say, Nutella or cinnamon pecan, or again, the options are unlimited.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Rosa is with us in Waterford. Rosa, hi.
Hello. I was wondering, do you use the cake flour? Because I've seen that on the store shelves, and you know, wondering what's the main difference. But in most recipes, it usually calls for all-purpose flour, not cake flour.
Oh, when do we use cake versus all-purpose, Sean?
Okay, so the difference between the two is the protein content in there, right? The gluten that is waiting in there for us to activate it with some liquid. So a cake flour tends to be a little bit lighter, has a little less protein in it. For something like a bread, I would not be using a cake flour because it doesn't have enough protein, or it doesn't have enough gluten in it to really develop and get a strong enough dough that can withstand the rise. So for like for something like a cinnamon bun or a brioche dough, I might go more towards a bread flour, which has more gluten in it, as opposed to maybe a cake or even the pound cake. That might have a little less, and I wouldn't be so apprehensive to use a cake flour. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. So with the pound cake, though, it sounds like we might be able to do it either way.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to get a different result, right? Mm. I tend to stick with an all-purpose flour for the pound cake, pretty standard. But again, for something like a brioche dough, I definitely would not go with a cake flour for it. If anything, I would either go all-purpose or a little bit heavier with bread flour.
Rosa, thanks a lot for calling in. Hope that helps out. We're talking to Sean Bolduc for this week's edition of Food Friday. He's the owner of The Baked Lab in Madison. We're looking at ways to get creative with our holiday baking, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite thing to bake this time of year, or for somebody else to bake and then you eat? Are there favorite family recipes you're always sure to make if you're not baking for as big a crew as usual this year? Are you going to try something new? And do you need some help with your baking? Maybe a question you have for something you're going to tackle this very weekend. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Support for WPR comes from businesses like Bremer and Trollop Law Offices and Agrace. Business support plays an important role in WPR success. Details on becoming a business sponsor are at wpr.org/sponsor.
The 2011 political district map changed the game for Wisconsin.
You know, it was pretty much of a Democratic landsliding. You know, we got wiped out. And then somebody said to me, well, don't worry, we're still in control of the assembly. I said, how can that be?
Listen to WPR Reports Mapped Out and find out why maps matter so much. It's at wpr.org/mapped out or wherever you get your podcasts.
Wisconsin Public Radio stays connected with the whole state. thanks to its network of 7 bureaus. With reporters on the ground across Wisconsin, WPR provides a news service that connects with issues that matter to your life. Stay in touch with WPR.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Sean Bolduc, owner of the Baked Lab in Madison. We're talking about holiday baking and ways to get creative with some classic recipes. You can join in with your holiday baking favorites or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lori posted there. She says, we always make snickerdoodles, and we always use colored sugar to decorate. And I love a lot of families, of course, Sean, have their traditions every year. You got to have blank. Are there favorites of yours this time of year?
Totally. So I shared the sticky bun recipe with you guys because I always make cinnamon buns for my family when I'm visiting for the holidays. It is like just a tradition that's kind of come about over the past 10 years. So that's one of my favorite things. The other thing I got to tell you, I'm from Boston originally, and my family is still out there. My dad is one of 17 children. And I know, right? And my meme used to always make what we call the Swedish pastry. And that reminds me of the holidays as well. It was this mixture of a puff pastry with a shoe dough on top of it, covered in sugar glaze and maraschino cherries. And it just reminds me of the holidays.
And she was baking in bulk, it sounds like.
She was definitely baking in bulk. I don't know how she did it. I don't know how she took care of 17 or feeding 17 kids at the same time. It's wild.
Now, earlier we were talking about flour for cakes. I'm a big fan of when people make, I've never made it myself, a flourless chocolate cake. What goes into making that?
Yeah, flourless chocolate cake really just takes the flour out of it, right? So we've got something like some chocolate mixed with butter, and then we're mixing in some eggs directly into that melted mixture. And then that's pretty much the extent of it. It's going to be a denser cake, right? It's going to be more like a really dense fudgy brownie, but it's also delicious in its own right.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Sherry is with us in Amherst. Sherry, hi.
Hi, this is Sherry. I'm calling from Amherst, and I just wanted. Hi. Oh,
Sherry, we lost you there. What baked good did you want to tell us about?
Okay, my sister Dolly. Okay.
You're cutting in and out. I got a note from our producer that your sister makes a cheesecake recipe with a secret ingredient that is cottage cheese. Sorry we lost your line there, Sherry. I've not heard of that. I don't think cottage cheese and cheesecake, Sean?
I have actually never heard of that either. I mean, I guess that it makes sense, right? It's another type of dairy. It's a thickener. Definitely. I'd be interested in trying that out, although I'm not a huge cottage cheese fan myself.
I understand you do make cheesecake, though. What is your favorite? And you can, this is another one. Once you know how to make cheesecake, I know you can do a lot of different things with it. What's your favorite way to jazz up a cheesecake?
I mean, I got to be honest with you. Cheesecake in its natural form, just like slightly heightened with a really good vanilla, is perfect to me. But I've done everything from adding, okay, this is a little wild. I've added black sesame to cheesecake. So we've got a little bit of like a different peanutty flavor going on in there, and added some raspberry sauce to it. And I think black sesame and raspberry make a fantastic pair. So that's kind of something wild I've done in the past.
Interesting. That sounds pretty good. Sherry, thanks again for calling in and sharing that with us. Let's see. How about cookies, Sean? What's a cookie we can tackle maybe outside of some of the holiday favorites, or a way to jazz up some of the holiday favorites?
Yeah. So I'm always a big fan of, like, again, going back to these basic recipes and then building on them using my own creativity. So I love something like a really good shortbread cookie, and then finding new ways to jazz it up. Maybe this year adding some matcha to it, or adding some fennel to it, and kind of playing with some flavors from there.
Cool. Let's go to Ingrid now in Eagle River. Ingrid, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment about your the caller about the flourless chocolate cake. What I do is I put cooked quinoa in a food processor along with cocoa, sugar, and eggs and butter, and mix it all up and pour it in a pan, and it does turn out like a cake. But like the other person mentioned, it is a little denser, but it's not as dense as a brownie. It does taste like a chocolate cake, and it it helps for people who have gluten allergies.
Huh. Ingrid, you said quinoa in your cake.
Quinoa.
Yeah, okay. Sean, that's interesting. People trying different grains, in this case, I guess, a gluten-free grain in their baking.
Yeah, I'm being stumped today. These are some new ideas. I've never actually heard of quinoa in a flourless chocolate cake, but, you know, it's a starch of sorts and would definitely add a little body to it. And it's probably pretty mild in flavor, so it might add just like a little nuttiness to the chocolate cake. That sounds delicious. I might have to look up a recipe for that one, too.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Sean Bolduc, baker based in Madison, owner of The Baked Lab. He's giving us a lot of inspiration for holiday baking, new twists on some old classics along the way. Hey, here's a challenge for you, Sean. If we can't get together with people and we want to ship them a baked good, what is in your arsenal that would travel the best?
Yeah, you know, you got to go back to those good old cookie recipes, right? Cookies travel the best. One of the things that my grandmother always taught me was when you throw your cookies in a tin to travel, throw a little piece of bread in there and it'll help keep them nice and moist while they're traveling and won't stale them as quickly. So that's definitely one thing that I would stick to for mailing this winter. People always ask me if they can ship my cakes, and I'm like, I definitely cannot get a cake in the mail to you. I wish I could, though.
Let's go to cottage cheese. Let's go to Mary Beth in New Berlin. This is interesting. Mary Beth, hi.
Hi. I heard that woman that kept getting cut off. My mother made my father a cheesecake with cottage cheese every year for his birthday. And it was just, we all looked forward to it. We only got it once a year. We couldn't wait. And last year was my father, the 100th anniversary of my father's birthday. So I made one. It was so good.
It came out okay. Are you using your mom's recipe, Mary Beth?
I am.
And wow. Does it, I mean, I worry, does it seem like I'm eating cottage cheese in the cheesecake, or is it just kind of all blend in?
No, because you mix it up, and it's got gelatin and egg and heavy cream and maraschino cherries, and you put it into a graham cracker crust. Mm. And I told my sister I was making, she said, I'll be there.
Interesting. Mary Beth, thank you so much for sharing that. And Sean, you know, part of it is the delicious recipe. Part of it, though, is the memories and the occasion, the anniversary of her father's birthday in this case. And I know you do wedding cakes and things like that. How important is it to have that, I guess, that memory and that celebration that goes along with our baking?
Totally. I mean, baking is all about memory and I agree with that. So oftentimes when I'm making wedding cakes or wedding desserts for a couple, I often start with asking them, is there something nostalgic, like some type of dessert that their family always had for special occasions that they want to incorporate into their special day? And so it's always fun to hear, you know, my grandmother always made lemon pie. And I'm like, okay, well, how can we recreate a lemon pie for this special day and find a new twist to add to it?
And in our last few moments, Sean, do you have advice on making a cake look good? Like, I could bake a cake. It doesn't usually look great. It looks like those, you know, those cake fails that people put on the internet. Do you have a tip to make them kind of social media, Instagram ready, as people say?
Oh, man. So I would say the two things to, if you want to up your cake game, is to get yourself a little turntable to decorate cakes on. They're pretty inexpensive. And also a straight edge. Whenever you're putting buttercream or something like that onto a cake, using a straight edge and your turntable, you're going to get a nice clean surface. And that would probably be my best piece of advice for upping your cake game this Christmas.
Fantastic. Sean, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. You have a great afternoon.
you two. That's Sean Bolduc, baker based in Madison, owner of the Baked Lab. He teaches baking in addition to doing it, and he talked with us about ways to get creative with our holiday baking this year. You can find recipes for those breakfast buns and that great pound cake recipe. We've got it over at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you can share your holiday baking experiments with us on the Ideas Network Facebook page.